Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We know that vulnerable populations are paying the highest price, our seniors, our nursing homes, and our poorer communities. They are the ones where you have higher infection rates and you have higher risk and higher exposure.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, May 5th. Governor Andrew Cuomo on Saturday, and yes, everywhere we turn, the coronavirus pandemic, at least in this country, becomes a story of racial injustice. From the state of New York's latest population sampling for COVID-19 antibodies, that's who had the virus already, the survey found Latino or Latinx people were much more likely to have had the virus than anyone else, 25% of all Latinos in the city. And 17% of blacks, compared to 11% of Asians and just 7% of whites. If those numbers are accurate from the state sample, those disparities are a reflection of economic inequalities that, frankly, go back 400 years and create more underlying health conditions and put more black and brown people in frontline, at-risk, lower-paying jobs that we now call essential. Most of you know this by now. So as we've been asking many guests, what does racial justice look like in a COVID-19 era, short term? And can this be an opportunity to get more serious about equality long term when the viral cloud lifts? With me now, Peniel Joseph, professor of history, political values, and ethics at the University of Texas in Austin. He is also host of a podcast called Race and Democracy, which deals with COVID-19, among many other things. And he's got a new book called The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. So we'll talk about COVID-era racial justice and the book, too, and maybe compare New York and Texas a little bit. Professor Joseph, always great to have you on with us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Thank you for having me.
First of all, you live in Austin, where one of the big national events to get canceled by the pandemic was one of the first ones, South by Southwest. And I see the mayor there has just extended the stay-at-home order, even as the state of Texas has been making national news for letting restaurants and other businesses reopen. So watching from New York, I'm confused. Can you clear it up? How would you describe the open or closed status of the city of Austin?
I think, Brian, it's a question of being in a blue city, living in a blue city where people are sheltering in place, but a blue city in a red state, where governors are opening up at a more rapid pace than people who live in blue cities, including public health officials and elected officials, feel comfortable with. So there's that tension between living in Austin or even, say, living in Houston or Dallas, and then the wider state.
Are you ready, or are people ready, if you'd rather just look outward, to go to a restaurant in Austin with 25% capacity, which is, I think, what's allowed in Texas now? Or would it feel like scary germ city?
Yeah, I think the latter. I think people are sheltering in place. The university is doing online courses all the way through the summer. I don't know if schools are going to reopen in August, but it's the same here in Texas. At least the data that we have, African Americans are 12% of the population, 18% of the reported deaths. Not all states have reported deaths, and people are tracking this weekly, but you're still seeing that disproportionate disparity, even though there's a decline in black population in Austin, only about 7.8% because of gentrification. I think when the data comes out, we're going to see disproportionate death and disease in the parts of Austin where African Americans remain.
And you're teaching in Texas, but you're from New York, I know. And I heard you mention in your podcast Rikers Island and the rollback of bail reform that the state legislature just did as the rollback as a COVID health risk to the mostly black and brown inmates. For people who think COVID-19 and bail reform are entirely separate issues, can you make that link for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So cash bail, which most activists who are against mass incarceration have been trying to remove the money or the cash bail system. People who've not necessarily been, they've been charged, but no trials. I mean, the only reason they're not home is because they don't have the money to put up a bond. Disproportionately affects African Americans and Latinx people. Obviously, we all know the story of Kalief Browder, who was held in Rikers for 3 years and later died by suicide. So what we have in not just Rikers, but we have it here in Texas too, and in Austin, in jails, in just local city jails, disproportionately you have black and brown, predominantly men, increasingly women, who are just held, and their likelihood of getting COVID-19 is dramatically increased because of there's no social distancing, or it's very hard to social distance in the context that they're being held. And this goes all the way back, like you were alluding to 400 years, really goes back to the 1860s and 1870s in the convict lease system, this idea of this money bail system and African Americans being arrested for loitering, for being unemployed, and this was a way to exploit them after the end of racial slavery in terms of working for big companies that basically leased them from local municipalities, paid the municipality a charge per prisoner, and the average sort of lifespan for those who were caught up in the convict lease system, both black men and women, was about seven and a half years. So this really continues deep into the 21st century.
You know, there's been a lot of talk recently that maybe COVID will be the thing that wakes everyone else up from their delusions of equal opportunity in this country and leads to meaningful, longer-term systemic change. I have my doubts, but if that does happen, for you as a historian, does history suggest, or, you know, just as an analyst of current America, do you have any opinions about what that could look like?
Well, yeah, I think this is definitely an inflection point, but I think that what we're seeing in terms of not just sometimes we call this structural racism, but certainly it's racist policies that are being implemented at the granular level. You're seeing police departments physically assault and brutalize African Americans for not social distancing, not having a mask, and treating white Americans in a complete opposite way. You're seeing the way in which the police have so much discipline when the anti-government protesters in Michigan and elsewhere are right up in their faces at times with armed AK-47s and rifles and handguns and pistols, and there's no confrontation, and there's actually no arrests. And so we have a long way to go. I think the positive is that this is transforming all of our illusions about racial progress. I think we could think of racial progress now as progress that has occurred in archipelagos of access. And we think, of course, about Michelle and Barack Obama and Oprah Winfrey, but some of us might even personally know African Americans or Latinx people who've done incredibly well. And that's real. But for most African Americans and most Latinx folks, they don't reside in those bubbles of progress. And I think the only way we're going to see systemic change is like what you saw in 1963. 63 is a great year because it's the last year before sort of the flood of legislation that gets passed in 64, 65, 68, in terms of Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, Fair Housing. And in 63, what you find is just a lot of mass protests and demonstrations. We sort of dwell on the March on Washington, Brian, but there were thousands of protests throughout the year of 1963, so much so that John F. Kennedy said that there was a revolution happening right in the United States, and it could be violent or peaceful. And he said that live before the nation on June 11th, 1963. So I think we're at a critical inflection point. We're not seeing the demonstrations in the same way, obviously, because of COVID-19. But I think once there's a vaccine, and I think this election that's coming up is a huge inflection point. And when we say, how would that look? I think one of the ways it looks is that we both dismantle these structures of racial and economic and really gender oppression, and we guaranteed certain prerogatives of citizenship. And that might mean a universal basic income. That might mean universal health care. Everybody has Medicare for all. It might mean not only do people get housing vouchers, but people get some kind of access to what Dr. King called decent housing in the 1960s. So I think we have to measure racial justice not just by eliminating oppressive structures or violence against black and brown people, but by what is being guaranteed in terms of citizenship, and a citizenship that seems more co-equal to their white counterparts. And I would add that would include ending residential and public school segregation, because we can see with COVID-19, we can track the deaths and we can track the vulnerability based on zip codes and the way in which racial segregation really contours the lives of all Americans. And there are bubbles of opportunity and progress, and then there are large swaths that are really basically a racial wilderness, not just for African-American and Latinx people who are incarcerated, but people who are working class, working poor, who live in these segregated ghettos, that's what they are, who lack, you know, food security, who lack environmental justice and clean air and clean water, and asbestos-free buildings. So we've got a lot of work to do, but I do believe that this is a reckoning, and people are trying to people are really committed, and I see this in Austin, to try to transform this situation. The center that I lead, we have graduate students who are getting prepared to go out in the community, do racial data tracking, but do other things that are going to mitigate what's happening right here in Austin. And I think that's happening nationally. So I do think it's a really powerful inflection point. But history will be our judge in terms of how does this world look and the United States look 5 and 10 years from now.
Just on that point you were just making about this perhaps being a historical inflection point, I don't know if you think it's a good parallel or not, but I was thinking about how 10 years ago, after the disparate impact of the Great Recession became apparent, the Occupy movement got going and popularized the terms income inequality and the 1%. And I think that rolled up the hill to the influence of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, even if they never become president, as well as others. I'm just, you know, maybe we take heart from the fact that maybe that was our last big national crisis and something changed in the public consciousness. And I'm curious to think if you see a model from that recent history, even though I know I've heard you speak about how there are limits to the racial consciousness within the economic movement, within the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren movements, for example. But is that a good comparison?
Yeah, I think it's an apt comparison. The person I would use is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I think that she comes out of that that movement and that inflection point, and she's linked, as are really the others, to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the struggle for black citizenship and the Poor People's Campaign of 1967-68. People like Marion Wright Edelman are a part of that. Welfare rights organizers and activists are part of that. But I think AOC is important because this idea of a Green New Deal becomes something that sort of centers racial justice alongside of economic justice, because she's been very, very eloquent in talking about people who are Latinx and brown people and how they are disproportionately underserved and marginalized, whether we think about child care or elder care or access to education or the communities that they live in, or even facing these frontline public-facing jobs that make them more at risk for COVID-19. So I do think that at times you win not necessarily through a policy victory, but the way in which you expand the discourse of what is possible. And I think that what we've done since Occupy and since the recession of 08-09 is really expand the discourse of what is possible. Now we think about, at least I think tens of millions of Americans actually believe in this idea of both a Green New Deal and Medicare for all, which wasn't the case just 12 years ago. So I do think that this is another inflection point, and the country is going to have to go big, like we did when we think about the New Deal and the Second World War, even bigger than the Great Society, to try to transform these unequal conditions and really to try to save our democracy, because I think we are at a really inflection point, Brian, about like, what does American democracy mean? What does American citizenship mean? What does dignity mean? Does it mean, you know, dozens of elderly people in nursing homes just dying and their bodies are stacked up in a way that's completely, you know, disrespectful? Does it mean homeless people in L.A. and New York, their bodies are just stacked up and left in the streets? Or does it mean something? Does it mean something more? And we faced that question before in the past, and we've come out in a positive way. When you think about the Second World War, when you think about the New Deal, the Great Depression, and I think absolutely, with 30 million people filing for unemployment, this is another massive watershed moment. And again, history will be our judge of how do we try to transform this situation into something that's positive and something that's... Martin Luther King Jr. said that justice was what love looked like in public. And how do we turn this real ongoing rolling tragedy into justice?
So your book is The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. And if we usually think of them as one being the more militant, working outside the system, and one playing more the inside game, you write that without both of them working in their different ways, the impact of the civil rights movement may have been stifled. How do you think their different ways complemented each other?
Well, yeah, Brian, it's interesting to talk about this book in the context of COVID-19, because I think that both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., are dual sides of a revolutionary coin that are needed now more than ever. And I wrote this book because I thought that all the scholarship and the way in which we think about them publicly, it forces people to choose between being on Team Martin or Team Malcolm. And my argument is that you really can be both and embrace both. So Malcolm X was talking about black radical dignity. Dr. King was talking about black radical citizenship. Those concepts really converge and complement each other. For Malcolm, dignity meant human rights. For Malcolm, dignity meant an end to brutality and poverty. But Malcolm's different from King in this sense. Malcolm doesn't argue for the existence of black humanity to white people. He takes that as a given. So he's not interested in making that argument. In fact, what the argument Malcolm makes is that white America has committed a series of crimes going back to racial slavery against African Americans. Dr. King does something different. He's the defense attorney, I argue, to Malcolm's prosecuting attorney, where he defends black lives and Latino lives and Native American lives, all indigenous people, to whites. And he defends whites and their morality and their ethical compass to people of color. That's the role that he plays. He says that instead of having racial hatred, we should have racial rapprochement. But King makes the argument that we all, not just black people, because sometimes people misunderstand. He said we all have to suffer on the road to that racial rapprochement. And that suffering, he meant this idea of truth and reconciliation. And he talks about this at the March on Washington. It's the parts of the speech, Brian, that we don't really listen to because we love the I have a dream part. But he says at the March on Washington, now is the time to make real the promise of democracy. And he says that we're going to have to all struggle together and go to jail together to transform the society. He's saying this on August 28th, 1963. And you only have to go to jail together if you're in an unjust society. King realizes that, but he tries to change hearts and minds and public policy. The way they converge is by 1963-64, they start to realize both you need dignity and citizenship to transform this country. So King becomes somebody who's much more interested and comfortable talking about black pride, for instance. He becomes much more interested and comfortable talking about anti-war, anti-imperialism, anti-capitalism. Malcolm, for his part, becomes much more comfortable talking about human rights. He becomes much more comfortable talking about white allies and interracial coalitions and saying that, hey, there are white people who understand this struggle and can be part of our struggle to build a new world. And Malcolm's speech, The Ballot or the Bullet, is a great speech where he's talking about voting rights and why voting really counts and why it matters, but he also hedges and says if voting rights are not immediately guaranteed to African Americans, there's going to be racial violence because you can't exist in a society that's this unequal and this unjust. And Malcolm even makes overtures to King. I mean, they meet on March 26, 1964 at the U.S. Senate. That's their only meeting, when the Senate is filibustering the Civil Rights Act that's going to be passed on July 2nd of 1964. They take a couple of pictures. They say they're going to meet again. They don't meet again in person, but Malcolm listens to Dr. King. He's in the audience sitting next to Andy Young, Ambassador Andy Young, former mayor of Atlanta, one of the luminaries of the 20th century, civil rights activist, and one of King's most important lieutenants. He's sitting right next to Andy Young when Dr. King is delivering a speech before over 8,000 people in Harlem, right after he's been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Malcolm is impressed by the speech, talks about the speech positively a few days later in Harlem, and a couple of months later actually goes to Selma and goes to visit Dr. King in jail. He's not allowed to visit King, who's in jail protesting for voting rights acts, for voting rights. And he ends up speaking to young students of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Selma, and he's sitting next to Coretta Scott King, Dr. King, not only Dr. King's wife, but his really political partner and political compass in many ways. And he tells Coretta Scott King that, "I admire your husband. I'm not here to cause any trouble, and I just want the folks in Selma to understand that if they don't give Dr. King what he's looking for in terms of voting rights, there's going to be another alternative there." So when we think about Malcolm and Martin, we don't think about them converging, but they really serve as each other's alter ego.
And you note in the book that both men used religion to support their political goals, of course, one with Christianity and one with Islam. How do you compare or contrast that in the book, if you could give us a brief version?
Oh, absolutely. They are both deep men of faith. For Malcolm, Islam is his faith, and Malcolm is going to argue that Christianity is connected to slavery and suffering and death in Western civilization, and Islam is the faith of justice and dignity and equality. And when we think about Malcolm, Malcolm really tries to become this sort of global Islamic leader, especially by 64. He takes the Hajj to Mecca, but he's always a Muslim, even when he's part of the Nation of Islam. When we think about King, King has a deep Christian faith, but his Christian faith is connected to the social gospel. The social gospel is a strain of Christianity that makes an argument that when we think about the Bible and the Old and New Testament, we need to transform injustice while it's happening here on earth and not just wait to get to heaven to get the equality. So when we think about King and Malcolm, they become these religious leaders who try to turn religion into a secular faith for the world. And for them, it means this eradication of poverty, racism. And for King, it means the eradication of war. For both of them, it means really the transformation of capitalism. You know, both of them become drawn to social democratic ways of governance and political economy as the 60s progress. When we think about King, for King, it's a return to what he had read and had been interested in even while he was a college student at Morehouse and while he was in the seminary. For Malcolm, it really becomes something that he had been introduced to in a way, because his father was a Garveyite, and Garveyism is both black political self-determination and both pro-capitalist, but there's strains of Garveyism that are social democratic as well. So it's a return for both of them. But what's so interesting about both of them is how they converge with this idea of human rights. They both talk about dignity, citizenship, and human rights. And really, the toll that we're all taking right now in the context of COVID-19 is really connected to the world that they were talking about. They both, and I document this in the book, talk about racial slavery ad nauseum in speeches. So before there was a 1619 project for the New York Times, Malcolm X is doing his own 1619 project, and so is Dr. King. So they connect racial slavery to American democracy and racial segregation during the time of Jim Crow, and they argue that until the country comes to terms with racial slavery and its impact on American democracy, there can be no positive future and no racial rapprochement. And I think we're still in that time period. We're still in a time period where we still haven't come to terms with racial slavery. The legacy of racial slavery and the way in which it's evolved. And that includes what we were talking about earlier, Brian, the cash bail or money bail system. There's a reason why we have almost 2 million people, over 2 million people in prison, and disproportionately they're black and brown men and women. It's really connected to our founding, and until we grapple with that, we're never going to be able to put in place the policies that not only end racial and economic injustice, but guarantee certain rights of citizenship and dignity for all people, not just black and brown people, but for all people. If we get it for black and brown people, we're going to get it for everyone.
Good way to bring it back full circle to the present. And so we thank Peniel Joseph, professor of history, political values, and ethics at the University of Texas in Austin. He is also host of a podcast called Race and Democracy. And he's got a new book called The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. It's always great to speak to you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.